Let's get underway. We're only 12 minutes behind. It's very good. We're toying with the idea of it wasn't on the schedule, but showing a movie in here between 6 and 8. This is the 2 hours before the press conference. This would be, I just got told about it. It's about a tribe, a very primitive tribe with connections to the ET issue. Apparently it's pretty good. Can't guarantee anything. I haven't seen it, but Melissa Reed has this film, so I think we're going to go ahead with this. And so for those that aren't at the banquet, or for those that don't need to rest, right? I mean, you're a professional conference person. You go to like 4 or 5 a month. And I know this lady here, Sandra Behrman, goes to at least 120 a year. She can sit through like 83 presentations in a row. Absolutely. You come on in. We'll show this film, about 90 minutes. Run it from about, I guess, 6:15 or so to a little before 8. Even if you're going to the banquet, come on over. But if you're not going to the banquet, you may definitely like to do this. So there'll be a film. Is Melissa here? Melissa? Okay. Goji, Oji, some tribe. But it's apparently pretty cool. There you go. Hoagie. The Hoagie Indians? All right. Any other housekeeping? Banquet is still on schedule for 8 because we're in good shape. And George Norrie, for those who are concerned, is 4 to 6, all right? And he will be down shortly before that. But he'll be doing interviews. In fact, he's been doing interviews, which is why you have not seen him. He'll be doing interviews all day. All right, let's get underway. Few here this morning will be shocked to learn that the entire infrastructure of American academia, I went to several of those colleges for 6 years and finally got a degree after I begged them hard enough. I'm not joking. I actually did have to beg. 5,000 colleges and universities and hundreds of thousands of professors and teachers did not and have not stepped forward to embrace any aspect of UFO phenomena and government interference with the process of discovery. There are a few exceptions, obviously, but the few compared to the mass, clearly, indicting. With a few notable exceptions, the vast intellectual resource that is higher learning in the U.S. has stood down. It is easily the greatest academic failure in all of history. If only there was a paper bag large enough to put over their collective heads.
Our next speaker did not stand down. He's a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. His interest evolved out of his investigation of the sources of international conflict and its possible relationship with the unacknowledged extraterrestrial presence. He cites evidence. Extraterrestrial races are currently engaging humanity and the planet in a variety of ways. His new book, Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, The Challenge of Exopolitics, reveals U.S. policies on the extraterrestrial issues that form major challenges in educating the general public about those very issues.
He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and an MA in philosophy from the University of Melbourne, and he is the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, which is coming along and growing very, very fast. So,
please welcome Dr. Michael Sala to X Conference 2009.
Just a technical issue at the moment. Thrilled to be back here to the X Conference. I was at the very first X Conference 5 years ago, and it was really a momentous year for me. I was still at an American university. I was in a research position. Earlier that year, my first exopolitics book was published, and what got the interest of a Washington Post reporter, Peter Carlson, was some of the citations I made of President Eisenhower going to Edwards Air Force Base, and that it happened to be the 50th anniversary on February 20 of 2004. And so he wrote up a front-page story in the style section of the Washington Post, which was pretty good, and it was called President Eisenhower, the whole tooth, and nothing about the tooth, something like that. Kind of like, even though it had a kind of one of those amusing headlines, the story itself, I thought, was quite good in terms of presenting the case that there was, in fact, a meeting at Edwards Air Force Base featuring President Eisenhower. And at the time, I really didn't have that much evidence other than what I was able to find pretty much through kind of internet research. Not many witnesses were around. And so in the 5 years since, thankfully, there have been a number of people that have stepped forward. And I was really happy to see today Bill Kirkland come forward and Art Campbell talk about the Holloman Air Force Base incident. And there have been others that I've also found confirming the 1954 incident. And I think it's really a transition here in terms of being able to talk about meetings involving extraterrestrials and presidents to discuss nuclear diplomacy at the time. And I did talk about this in the first book, and I mentioned it in this new book that's just come out. And I think it's very important that we acknowledge the full spectrum of evidence that there is, but also look at the policy implications of it, because some of the evidence talks about diplomatic meetings between an American president and extraterrestrial representatives, and that's pretty far out. I know a lot of people have difficulty just accepting that UFOs are real, and is the evidence persuasive and conclusive, but we need to kind of look at the full spectrum, and I think that's why the exopolitics field for me is so inspiring, because we do look at all of the evidence, we look at all of the policy implications of it, and we have an open mind. We don't kind of come along and say, well, if there's no conclusive proof, we're not going to look at it and you know, and just kind of reject it out of hand. We look at it, we explore it, and I think that's really what characterizes those of us in the exopolitics movement, that we take a kind of open-minded approach to the evidence. We're still interested in finding proof, but we know that often proof is going to be elusive, but the evidence still stands. And if you have first-hand witnesses coming forward saying that they saw documents or they attended meetings or they were aware of a film or saw a film concerning an event such as President Eisenhower meeting extraterrestrials, then we look at that evidence and we give it a fair write-up and we evaluate it as best we can. And so that's the approach that I want to do today in terms of looking at some of the important issues that are concerned with the Obama administration and UFO ET disclosure, because they are some very important issues. And I think when we look at what presidential administrations have been trying to do over the years, we see that some of them have actually tried to find the truth, and that in fact presidential administrations are not these all-powerful entities that we often think they are, that they often have a lot of very talented, ambitious people who have succeeded in their respective professions and risen to very high office, whether it's president or chief of staff or cabinet secretary. And these people are used to kind of like finding the truth. And then all of a sudden they're confronted with a situation where they're told that, well, even though you're technically the president or a cabinet secretary, that you don't have need to know. And that comes as quite a shock to these people. And so what I'll be talking about today is just how a presidential administration can deal with that very profound realization that, yes, you are the president, or you are the cabinet secretary, but you don't have need to know access to this information. And so how would they deal with that? And so what I'm going to present today is really give you an idea of how I think people in the Clinton administration tried to deal with this issue, how they failed, and then how they are involved in the Obama administration having another crack at this issue to open it up. And I think what I hope to do is present to you what really is kind of like a chess game. It's like watching two grandmasters play and working out the way they position pieces, because I think there is a chess game being played out at the moment involving disclosure. And what I'll do, hopefully, is give you an insight into some of the moves that have been made, how positions have been set, so that later on we're going to have checkmate, which will be this disclosure. So here we have the first part where I'm going to be talking about the Rockefeller Initiative. Lawrence Rockefeller sent a letter on March 29, 1993 to Bill Clinton's science advisor. That letter was sent by Rockefeller's attorney, Henry Diamond, and the letter stated that Rockefeller was, quote, anxious to have a brief meeting with Dr. Gibbons, Special Assistant to the President for Science and Technology, to discuss the potential availability of government information about unidentified flying objects and extraterrestrial life. So whether Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton had any interest prior to Rockefeller's letter, I mean, they may have had, but as far as I've been able to tell, and no one else has kind of disputed this, that this was the first kind of indication that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were interested in the UFO question and interested in extraterrestrial life. So Bill Clinton, what would he do being president? He gets this letter from Rockefeller's attorney. He seeks an official briefing. So he asks James Woolsey, who was appointed by Clinton to be the CIA director, for information on UFOs. So Woolsey goes through whatever process he does to learn the truth from the CIA, and he basically says in a discussion, and this is what's been reported by Stephen Greer, that Woolsey was denied need-to-know access, and he allegedly said, quote, you know, they're treating me like a bagman that goes up to Capitol Hill, gets their $30 billion for the intelligence community, and brings it back. You know, I really don't know anything that's going on that sensitive, end quote. So this kind of gives you an idea into the mindset of a lot of elected political officials or those that are appointed to these very sensitive positions, that often that they can be treated as kind of like the bag man for a bureaucratic department, for an agency, to really go to Congress and get money or lobby for a particular piece of legislation, but they're not really given any really sensitive information. So we kind of see that sentiment being expressed there. So what does Woolsey do? Well, he is open to getting whatever information he can, and so he apparently accepts to be given an informal briefing, if we call it that, by Dr. Stephen Greer on December 13, who told him what civilian researchers had discovered about UFOs. So Woolsey, after that meeting, then orders the CIA to prepare a report on all its information about UFOs. So he's given a little bit of information, and he basically tells the CIA, well, I know there's something there, tell me everything you know. So the CIA does its thing, doesn't tell him too much, and then eventually it releases a sanitized report in 1996 that was titled The CIA's Role in the Study of UFOs, 1947 to 1990, and basically it describes the UFO phenomenon as really a cover for the real secrets, which was the U-2 and the SR-71, the Blackbird, and that the CIA kind of exploited that to make it look as though UFOs were real, but the real secret was the Blackbird. So that's what Woolsey was told, and I don't think he bought that, nor did the Clintons. Another thing that the Clintons did was they sent Webster Hubble to the Department of Justice, first as a White House liaison on January 23rd, 1993, and then as Associate Attorney General in April, he's appointed or confirmed in that position. So Hubble writes in his 1997 book, Clinton had said, if I put you over at Justice, I want you to find the answers to two questions for me. One, who killed JFK? And two, are there UFOs? Clinton was dead serious. I'd looked into both, but wasn't satisfied with the answers I was getting, end quote. So that's just another indication that Hubble tried at the Department of Justice to find what he could on UFOs, and he didn't get very far either. So what else happens to the Clintons to try to get information? Well, eventually both Clintons accept an invitation to go to the Teton Ranch near Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in 1995, to be briefed by Rockefeller himself. And they were given some information and a briefing document and so forth. It's reported that Hillary Clinton, after the briefing itself, basically told Rockefeller to kind of lay off, that this was too hot for them, they weren't going to move on it. It could really be damaging to the president's re-election prospects. But nevertheless, in December 1995, we see Hillary Clinton cooperating with the Rockefellers in drafting a letter to Bill Clinton to try to promote UFO disclosure. She was definitely interested in trying to move the disclosure process forward. The documentation proves that. There's an executive order that's released, Executive Order 12958, that was passed on April 17, 1995, that prescribed, quote, a uniform system for declassifying, safeguarding and declassifying national security information that would reflect a greater commitment to open government. And I think this was kind of reflective of the understanding that the Clintons developed, that after trying this kind of direct approach to try to get their hands on UFOs, they really didn't get anywhere, whether it's Department of Justice, CIA, whatever the president himself tried to do through his own executive office, they weren't getting anywhere. So they thought they'll try to do it in another way, which would be to pass an executive order that would lead to a relaxation of classification laws and to lead to the automatic declassification of documents after 25 years that hopefully would kind of shake loose some really interesting stuff on UFOs. I think that was really one of the important ideas behind that executive order. So that was the intent. The Clinton administration correspondence with the Rockefellers shows that Executive Order 12958 was discussed explicitly as a means of shaking loose some of these UFO files. So that is discussed in the documents that were released under the Freedom of Information Act. This is where John Podesta comes in, a very important figure. He was involved very prominently in the development of Executive Order 12958. He was aware of the Rockefeller Initiative and his views on 12958 as a tool in the disclosure process. He has been a strong proponent of that ever since. Of course, he was very interested in the X-Files and the question of ET, extraterrestrial life. And this is what he said about the X-Files shows. Quote, when the show about the aliens comes on, I get glued to the tube and try to figure out which government agencies to call to determine if the show's story is real or not, end quote. Well, you know, I mean, if that's just anyone on the street saying something like that, we wouldn't take it seriously. But here's someone that became Clinton's chief of staff eventually. So it's like, well, are they really trying to do this? I think they were. Podesta's influence in the White House, became White House Chief of Staff in 1998-2001. His signature issues are open government and declassification of national security files. He's aware of the Clinton administration's failure to release UFO files. So he understood that the Clintons did try very hard to shake loose whatever they could about UFOs from the various federal agencies, military departments, but they failed. It was really a clear failure. So he understands the need for priorities and a strategy to succeed the next time a Democratic administration comes to power. So you can think of it yourself. If you're someone like Podesta, very bright, chief of staff, you saw that the Clinton administration failed this time around. It was pretty clear that there was going to be a need to kind of rethink, come up with a strategy for the next time a Democratic administration comes to power. And they were probably thought through, well, what are the challenges here? What are the things that we're going to have to overcome if we can shake loose whatever the government has on UFOs? Clearly, the most important was this need-to-know access. The president and senior staff, if they denied need-to-know access to classified UFO files, that's a pretty big challenge. How do you deal with that? Someone makes a decision as to who gets needs to know, and the president and senior staff aren't necessarily given that need-to-know access. So how do you deal with that problem? And overclassification stifles efforts to release UFO files. So there's this whole problem of overclassification. Who has access, who doesn't, who has need-to-know, who doesn't. Roswell, of course, being a primary example of that, because that was one of the things that Clinton did try to get information on throughout his administration, they fell. No presidential oversight of federal agencies and departments with UFO information. Another big challenge. If you want to get your hands on UFO information and you're part of the president's team, well, the president doesn't have oversight of the agencies that really deal with this information. They don't know who has the access to the information. The CIA was a good example of that. Woolsey simply couldn't get access, nor could Hubble at the Department of Justice. Lack of presidential control over CIA, Department of Defense, black budget. Here's another big problem, is that these UFO projects, files, seem to be wrapped up with black budget projects that are funded by this budget, which is kind of like off the wall in terms of the amount of money which is raised through various illicit mechanisms that are part of a black budget. There were efforts to try to audit the DoD, 1998, 1999, 2000. The Inspector General of the Department of Defense tried to conduct an audit of the Department of Defense, found that on average there was $1.7 trillion every year that couldn't be accounted for, and that was something that was occurring under the Clinton administration. But nevertheless, there was no kind of effective control over that budget. UFO files increasingly shifted out of the federal agencies and departments into the control of contractors. In 1997, there was a very interesting incident that was described by Stephen Greer and Edgar Mitchell. Maybe we'll talk about that tomorrow, where this involved an admiral, a vice admiral who was chairman of the intelligence, head of intelligence in the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1997, who was given code, the code name for a particular UFO project. He tried to get access and was denied access. Well, I think that the Clinton administration would have been aware of that, that essentially control of the UFO files had been shifted out of federal agencies and military departments into the control of contractors, and contractors were cited as one of the entities that were basically involved in denying Admiral Wilson access to those files. So part B, Podesta's UFO agenda and Clinton support. After the 2000 election and we had George Bush elected, people start to think of, how can the Democrats get back in? What do we need to do? One of the ideas is to start up a liberal think tank, something that can challenge the conservative think tanks that are in existence. So George Soros commits $3 million for the creation of that in 2002. Soros heads the Open Society Institute, which is involved in the creation of the new think tank. He appoints one of his chief deputies, Morton Halperin, to be the person that heads that on behalf of the Open Society Institute. And they look around, who would be a person to head this think tank? And they think of someone like George Podesta would be ideal. John Podesta. Podesta is approached to head the Soros-inspired think tank and eventually accepts. So then you have the creation of the Center for American Progress. On July 7, 2003, it's first called the American Majority Institute, but then it's quickly renamed on September 1 for the Center for American Progress. Hillary Clinton is also involved in the Center for American Progress. It's cited as a White House staff in readiness. There's the thinking here is that, eventually there's going to be another Democratic administration coming in. We just can't kind of sail away, do our thing for another 4 years, 8 years, until Democrats get another chance. Let's get ready, let's organise, let's prepare, do what we need to so that we can kind of hit the ground running, because that's what we need to do if we're going to make progress. And so that, I think, is why the Center for American Progress was supported so strongly by Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton as well. And in fact, some reporters actually say that the Center for American Progress is, in fact, an official Hillary Clinton think tank. So you have a United Press, UPI, saying that. Also, a reporter for The Nation says, in looking at Podesta's center, there's no escaping the imprint of the Clintons. It's not completely wrong to see it as a shadow government, a kind of Clinton White House in exile, or a White House staff in readiness for President Hillary Clinton, end quote. So if you think about it, I think this kind of makes a lot of sense. This is what the Center for American Progress is trying to do, organize as many Clinton-era people to kind of think together, strategize, come up with an agenda, so that the next time the Democrats come in, and the thinking was at the time that it probably would be Hillary Clinton, that they could really hit the ground running and move forward on the issues that they feel are important. At the very same time as this Center for American Progress is being created, you have John Podesta going out there talking about UFOs. In October 2002 and also October 2003, he appears at the National Press Club to talk about the need to declassify 1965 files on UFOs concerning the Kecksburg crash. And he says, quote, "It's time to open the books on the question of government investigation of UFOs. It ought to be done because it's right. it ought to be done because the American people can handle the truth, and it ought to be done because it's the law, end quote. So it's very clear Podesta thinks that this needs to be done for those reasons, and I think Podesta is a very determined man, and I think that he had a strategy. I think that it was no accident that at the very time that the Center for American Progress was being kind of institutionally set up, that he's going around giving, gave these two very prominent UFO talks. I think he was green-lighted to do that, kind of as a very important signal that, yes, they haven't forgotten about the UFO issue and that they care about it. Podesta, after all, is the president for the Center for American Progress, and if it is a kind of Clinton White House staff in readiness, then we're getting a sense of what the next Clinton administration had in mind. Podesta's support of government openness and declassification of national security files are the means of gaining access to UFO files. This is the way that they're going to do it. Try and aim to get as much declassification going as possible, kind of promote open government and transparency as the means for achieving this. As president of the Center for American Progress, Podesta develops a list of priorities for the next presidential administration based on government openness and transparency. These are going to be the catchwords for moving forward on a number of issues that are of importance, and of course the UFO disclosure issue is kind of like embedded within that. So Podesta writes white papers on, quote, the hidden threat combating government secrecy in the 21st century in 2006, then too much secrecy puts our nation at risk in 2008. So, you know, the big challenge here that Podesta is identifying for the next Democratic administration is the secrecy, that the secrecy system needs to be overcome. This is a real threat, a real challenge to American democracy and to the priorities of the next Democratic institution. Why did Obama choose Podesta, a solid Clinton supporter who has worked with Bill Clinton since 1970? So Bill and John Podesta have been buddies for a long, long time. So why did Obama choose Podesta? Was he simply co-opting a White House staff in readiness that had been prepared for the unsuccessful Hillary Clinton presidential campaign? I think that's basically what he did. He recognized that, you know, there was some organization that had gone into this. There was an agenda, there was a plan, a strategy all in place to kind of move forward to ensure that the next administration, Democratic administration, that they thought would be Clinton, would be successful in all the agendas. And so when Obama won the nomination, I think he understood that it was quite sensible to kind of like co-opt that, or to just accept that preparation was something that he could support. And so I think he chose Podesta for that reason. It did definitely help as well that Podesta shares a Chicago background, close to Rahm Emanuel, who was also a former Clinton-era figure, who's the new White House Chief of Staff, and Pete Roos, who's Obama's senior advisor and Obama's Chief of Staff when he was in the Senate. So both of those figures are close to Podesta. So Podesta's playing, I believe, an influential behind-the-scenes role in promoting his signature issues of transparency and open government. Obama's primary support base and ideological orientation is similar to the Clintons. Obama's inherited the policy orientation of the Clinton administration towards open government and strengthening executive oversight in the national security arena. Very important that, I think, is what the Clinton administration people recognize is going to be essential for the next Democratic administration. So Obama to continue the Clinton administration efforts toward declassification of national security files in order to pry loose UFO information. I think at some level Obama may be aware of that, or he was comfortable with that. So what happens when Obama gets elected or takes office? So what are his first presidential actions? In January 21st, his first full day in office, he issues presidential memoranda on transparency and open government and Freedom of Information Act. Obama instructed, quote, all members of his administration to operate under principles of openness, transparency, and of engaging citizens with their government. Precisely the things you would have imagined that they would have done if Podesta's strategy was what was being followed. You would basically act very quickly on these very processes. So Obama said in a press conference, for a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rule said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over. Starting today, every agency and department should know that this administration stands on the side not of those who seek to withhold information, but those who seek to make it known. End quote. So this is kind of like, you know, the first cannon shot. You know, you can imagine it's like a shot across the bow of those that want to maintain the secrecy system. The Obama administration has basically said here that they are going to come out and they're going to hit the ground running. They're going to move aggressively and fast to declassify files and shake loose whatever's in there that they think ought to be released to the public. Both memoranda reflect Podesta's influence and response to the first challenge identified earlier, the need to know access that is denied to presidents and overclassification of files, including UFOs. Obama and presidential records, also another important initiative. On that very first day, January 21st, Obama issues the Executive Order 13489 that facilitates release of presidential records. A 30-day review period now in place to determine if executive privilege is justified in preventing release. So basically trying to accelerate the process by which presidential records are released. So the first release under Executive Order 13489 led to the release of approximately 250,000 pages of Ronald Reagan's records on April 13. So that's only 5 days ago. Here you have the first concrete result of this executive order released or passed by Obama on his first full day in office, trying to shake loose a lot of these overclassified files or files that have been withheld for executive privilege. Executive Order 13489 reflects Podesta's influence and response to challenge number one, the need to know and overclassification. So all of these were issued on the very first day of Obama's first full day in office. They were prepared, they were ready, and these reflect Podesta's influence when Podesta was co-chair of White House, Obama's transition team. Obama issues Presidential Policy Directive number one, which expands the power of the National Security Council to oversee all executive departments and agencies. The directive introduces new members into top-level NSC meetings, including the Energy Secretary and the US Representative to the United Nations. Most significant is that Obama's National Security Advisor, General James Jones, was given direct authority to develop and implement policy throughout the NSC system. The importance of this particular policy directive is that the NSC is really a kind of diffuse network of committees, projects that are loosely under the NSC system, but in the furthest reaches, the NSC really doesn't chair them. Whatever committees and whatever projects are subordinate to them, the NSC really didn't know what was going on. And so with this presidential policy directive, Obama was signaling that what they were going to do now was actually have the NSC function more as a unified whole, because the way in which I think they understood that those opposed to disclosure, that they succeed by having a diffuse kind of system where there isn't oversight, aren't clear lines of authority, there's a lot of ambiguity into who's in charge and what's going on, and that if you're going to really shake loose files that are overclassified or that have information concerning UFOs, you really need to bring the NSC system under kind of much more centralized control. And they chose Jones for that role because he has the kind of clout or the authority or the experience to achieve some outcome. So this deals with the second challenge I described earlier, the executive oversight of federal agencies and departments. And the fourth challenge, which is government contractors, because throughout the NSC system and committees and various projects that are kind of authorized, you have government contractors fulfilling contracts. And so this is a way in which you can kind of have direct oversight of the contracts that have been awarded and what's going on in those. Because remember, I mentioned earlier that Tom Wilson, that admiral in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was denied access. Well, something like this policy directive would overcome a problem like that. Presidential memo on government contracting, another very important initiative. That March 4 memo says the report, quote, reports by agency Inspector Generals, the Government Accountability Office, and other independent reviewing bodies have shown that non-competitive and cost reimbursement contracts have been misused, resulting in wasted taxpayer resources, poor contractor performance, and inadequate accountability for results. More significantly, Obama signaled that he was intent on restoring government oversight and fulfilling government programs. Quote, "It is essential that the federal government have the capacity to carry out robust and thorough management and oversight of its contracts in order to achieve programmatic goals and avoid significant overcharges and curb wasteful spending," end quote. Basically, what this is doing is saying that it's through these open-ended contracting processes whereby various industries or corporations are given these non-competitive contracts where they do all sorts of things for all sorts of government agencies, military departments that are under no oversight, that basically run well over budget, and no one kind of comes in and sorts things out, that's going to stop under the Obama administration, or that at least he's going to make an effort to bring some oversight into the way in which these government contracts are handed out. So again, this is a kind of major initiative to try and deal with the way in which the secrecy system is maintained through the government contracting process. So that deals with the third challenge, which is the black budget, because that really does come through the government contracting, the way in which contracts are awarded in a non-competitive fashion, where funds kind of come out of nowhere to fund vast projects that are awarded to industries that have no kind of oversight of what they're doing and who really determine who has access. It may ultimately be that a need-to-know access is determined by some program manager that is hired by a corporation to fulfill a government contract with a major defence on a major defence contract. So, in other words, people making these need-to-know access decisions are in the corporations, nothing to do with government. So, how to overcome that? You basically put in place a mechanism whereby you have oversight of the funding, trying to put pressure on that system. That's what I think is going on there with that memorandum. Another memo is the memo on scientific integrity. He issued the memo to promote transparency in the preparation, identification, and use of scientific and technological information in policy making. His memorandum instructs federal agencies to make available to the public the scientific or technological findings or conclusions considered or relied on in policy decisions. Significantly, Obama's memorandum gives appropriate whistleblower protections in order to, quote, ensure the integrity of the scientific and technological information and processes on which the agency relies in its decision making, end quote. So what this memorandum is basically identifying is that there's a lot of technological secrets that exist out there, and that as far as the Obama administration is concerned, they're going to promote transparency. That as far as any kind of sequestered technologies that might relate to some of the things that that have been seen in terms of UFO flight performance, you know, the kind of UFOs being able to kind of move from a standstill to kind of Mach 10 instantaneously, as Milton Torres described earlier, that those kinds of technologies, if they're being studied secretly in various by various contractors or secret projects, that these are things that the Obama administration is going to move to have made public, that they're going to promote openness on those. So Obama's memorandum makes possible the release of suppressed technological information concerning UFOs, deals with challenges number one, need to know, and challenge number four, government contractors. So these memoranda, I think, are all part of what I see as being a kind of a strategy for how to deal with this secrecy system, which is well entrenched, has been around for 50 years, and basically it has shut out democratic administrations again and again. And it's kind of like almost like Democrats have finally gotten together and said, well, we're not going to stand for it anymore, we're going to come out with a strategy, and we're going to move on this. And I think this is what we're seeing here with these memoranda and Obama's initiatives. Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2009, a very important initiative. That's been launched in both houses, that protects whistleblowers who report abuses while working on national security issues and for federally funded contractors. Obama's indicated his support for the act, which is still to pass the House. An earlier version was already passed by the Senate. What this Whistleblower Protection Act does for the very first time is that it protects whistleblowers from reprisal for reporting to internal managers abuses that they've seen or they've witnessed, that any whistleblower that reports this in the past has been subjected to penalties. And so now the Obama administration, through its support of the Whistleblower Enhancement Act, is signalling that it is going to ensure that any whistleblowers are given protection. And also whistleblowers from corporations, that's never been done before, that whistleblowers from corporations can come forward and also be protected because they are the ones that are performing federally funded contracts, and so the Whistleblower Protection Act argues that they should be also given this kind of protection if those corporations want to continue getting government contracting, which is a really important idea. So that deals with challenges number two and three, the executive oversight problem and the black budget. There's also support for a truth commission that has been proposed by Senator Patrick Leahy. There was a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on March 6, and a petition for that has almost 100,000 signatures. I'm kind of going to move through this a little more quickly now because I've kind of only got 15 minutes now, so excuse me if I don't give you that much time to read through it. They're going to target the any abuses that include, quote, the use of torture, warrantless wiretapping, and extraordinary rendition, and executive override of laws, end quote. And I think it's that executive override of laws which is really the important thing here when it comes to the Obama administration wanting to kind of shake loose any information concerning UFOs. Obama so far hasn't signalled his support for Leahy's initiative, but I do know that Leahy has been kind of advised by people that are involved in the disclosure movement, so he's very familiar with some of these issues. And I think that's going to move forward as the Bush-era memos on CIA interrogation and torture guidelines have just been released, that four of those have now been made public. So what are some of the key personnel in the Obama administration? Dennis Blair, I think, is a very important person, retired Navy Admiral who was formerly in charge of the Pacific Command, the largest geographic command in the US, that's based in Honolulu, Hawaii. Blair is responsible for Obama's daily briefings. An important thing about Blair is that Blair has privately confirmed that aircraft carrier-sized USOs that travel at 200 knots are a major problem for the US Navy. He had a conversation with Bob Dean, something that Bob Dean told me at the International UFO Congress earlier this year, and fortunately it was made public by Project Camelot, so I don't have to keep it secret anymore. But basically, Dennis Blair did disclose that the Navy has real problems with aircraft carrier-sized USOs that travel at 200 knots, and the Navy's having a heck of a time trying to work out who they are, who they belong to. Another person is General James Jones, National Security Advisor. He's a retired Marine Commandant, briefly served as President of the Institute for 21st Century Energy. He was also a Director on Boeing's Finance Committee at a time when it sought to release anti-gravity technology. That was rebuffed, but I know that in 2007 Boeing did try to release anti-gravity technologies because they wanted to develop it for commercial use, but they were denied declassification. Jones was on that Boeing Finance Committee that I believe knew of it, and I think Jones would have been the point man. It would have made a lot of sense to be the point man for Boeing to see if he could shake loose some of these anti-gravity technologies. He wasn't successful, but nevertheless, a Department of Energy official did disclose this to Tom Vallone, who then passed it on to others. Jones has expanded power under Presidential Policy Directive Number 1 to oversee the NSC. I'm going to kind of move quickly, so I'll skip some things. Clinton at the Department of State. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, is now responsible for U.S. diplomacy. Podesta acted as an intermediary to ensure continued Clinton role in the White House and UFO ET disclosure. Her Rockefeller UFO involvement and interest in unifying humanity in response to ET showing up suggests she wants to influence ET policy. I think Hillary Clinton knows enough about what's going on that, yes, the Clinton administration was shut out. If they played good, then they might be given some some jewels, you know, some information about UFOs. But I think Clinton is a pretty sharp. I think she's very ambitious. I think she doesn't want to just be given some kind of, you know, be given some information about UFOs. I think she really wants to play a role in setting policy on ETs, on UFOs. She wants to influence that, and as Secretary of State, she has a position to do just that. Leon Panetta at CIA, I think I'll kind of move quickly, Clinton's Chief of Staff, 94-97. I think he was put into that position because he knew of the Rockefeller Initiative, he knew of the need to try to shake loose whatever the CIA had on UFOs, and Panetta was recommended by Podesta as the Director of CIA, hoping, I believe, that he could succeed where James Woolsey failed in getting access to UFO files. And there's another element here that I wanted to kind of introduce, which is a covert Navy group. I think there is a role here that's being played by some military departments to disclose information concerning UFOs. On February 12, 2008, a serving US Navy officer with several decades of distinguished military service discloses the first of a series of UN meetings to discuss UFOs, ETs. Contrary to what you may have heard from a lot of people, there has been independent confirmation of those meetings having gone forward. So the meetings have occurred at the UN, and that they have been covered up, or there hasn't been kind of public confirmation of this, but nevertheless there's been multiple independent corroboration that those meetings did occur. This officer claims to be reporting to a covert Navy working group led by several admirals. So this is a serving US Navy officer who claims that he was given the go-ahead by a Navy working group led by a bunch of admirals to basically tell UFO researchers that, hey, guys, the UN is having secret meetings on UFOs. You should know about this. The credentials of the Navy officer have been checked by a number of researchers. Bob Vanderklok is here. I've also checked his credentials. A number of other researchers have also done so. Dr. Bruce McAbee, I think his verification of the credentials were very important. Dr. McAbee was at work when he agreed to meet this Navy officer. He was at work at the US Naval Warfare Center where the Navy officer visited him unescorted. So obviously the Navy officer had the sufficient security clearance and he was in full dress uniform to be able to just walk up to the office of Dr. Bruce McAbee at the Naval Warfare Center to just talk to him about his involvement in this this disclosure of UFO meetings at the UN. One of the things that I think is worth mentioning by the naval officer is that there is a division of labor amongst the US military services on the UFO ET issues. The Army, Department of Energy, Department of Homeland Security, they're in charge of security and bases. So, for example, Dulce, New Mexico, there is an underground facility at Dulce, New Mexico. I was at the first Dulce conference that was held there in March of this year, and it's pretty clear. I mean, the locals came forward and they told their story. There is a lot of things happening over there in Dulce involving underground military operations, Delta Force, Army people are all over the place. UFOs are seen all the time. UFOs are, and extraterrestrials, should mention that extraterrestrials, that the police at Dulce have confirmed that, yes, their citizens have been abducted by extraterrestrials and have been subjected to various experiments or activities that the extraterrestrials are conducting. So there's confirmation that, yes, there is military activities at Dulce, yes, there is an underground facility at Dulce, and yes, there is extraterrestrial activities in the vicinity of the Dulce underground base. And some of the witnesses that have come forward to talk about the underground base at Dulce have always talked about Delta Force, Army security, and Department of Energy personnel. U.S. Air Force, according to this Navy officer, is in charge of technology and contact. So I mentioned the Eisenhower ET meetings, 1954-1955. Bill Kirkland and Art Campbell talked about the 55 meeting. I talked about the 54 meeting in other conferences and also in an earlier book. The U.S. Air Force was involved in that. So this checks out that the Edwards Air Force Base, Holloman Air Force Base were used for these meetings. So it does seem that the U.S. Air Force is involved in these face-to-face contacts with extraterrestrials, so the Air Force conducts these diplomatic negotiations or hosts them, and that the technology is developed through the Air Force. The Navy is in charge of policy, apparently, that the way in which these technologies and these personnel that have been given the internet access are deployed, that these are all kind of policy issues, that the Navy is responsible for that, that there is a secret space fleet, an astronaut corps, and actually President Reagan actually mentioned this in his the Reagan diaries. There's an entry from 1995 where he talks about having a space shuttle capacity of 300 people. Well, you know, think about it. The space shuttle takes 5 to 7, and a maximum you could have 8 people in any of the space shuttles. 5 space shuttles were built that were operational for space travel. There was a 6th shuttle that was really a testing shuttle, but that makes 5 shuttles. Well, you think about it, how many times would you have to fly the space shuttle up into space to kind of put 300 people in orbit? And how could you host them in orbit? The International Space Station doesn't have anything like that capacity. And in 1985, the International Space Station was just an idea. Why would the Navy be interested in disclosing to civilian researchers that there are official or secret meetings being hosted at the United Nations concerning UFOs? Why is the Navy concerned about this? This is my explanation. This is my kind of theory for it. I think that the corporations have taken over an inordinate influence or control of UFO ET files. According in 1969, according to Ben Rich, he talked about the Nixon administration kind of undergoing a purge where control of UFO files passed from the military to corporate hands. And we kind of see this in whistleblowers that have come forward. For example, Project Camelot, they have this archivist X who's come forward, and he disclosed that he, in 1985, he worked for 6 months in a corporation that actually had all of these secret government files and documents and all material concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life. And yes, UFOs are real, and yes, there have been meetings, and yes, extraterrestrials are very much part of the equation, and there have been abductions. That these were all things that he saw in these files that were in a corporate facility. Why not in a military facility? No, they've been shifted out of the military's facilities, out of any government agency, and placed into the hands of these corporations. And where is this secret UFO ET archive now? Well, it's with Boeing. The Boeing Corporation holds this secret archive. So is it any wonder that Boeing was trying to declassify some of the anti-gravity files? Admiral Tom Wilson denied need to know access by corporate contactors in 1997. I mentioned that earlier. New World Order is based on the ascendancy of transnational corporations, which would benefit the most from loss of policy influence of the US Navy. I think that overall, if we look at what is the New World Order, how does that stand, how does that kind of present itself, how would it like to develop? Basically, it would be the ascendancy of transnational corporations. Transnational corporations would have all control, all influence, or anything of any great significance would be a trade secret, where corporations would make the decision as to who has need to know access, as to which of these files, which of these technologies will be developed, will be released to the public, and that those that have these positions on these transnational corporations, they would be the ones that would have all the power. And I think the US Navy quite correctly has understood that this is a threat to American sovereignty and a threat to the interests of the Navy. And I think that's why they're doing this. Threats against UN diplomats are claimed to originate from several corporations. The UN diplomats that were part of these meetings in February 12, 13, 14, 2008, and there were subsequent meetings, that these UN diplomats have been threatened. We've had independent corroboration of this, and senior diplomats have said that they have been threatened by entities that if they talk about the UFO meetings, that they would suffer severe consequences. And these diplomats were frightened that whoever was doing this were very powerful entities. And according to this Navy officer that's been part of these disclosures, that Clay and Sean Pickering were the ones that were responsible for first alerting myself and then alerting others to these Navy officials, that this officer basically said that those threats were traced by the Navy to several corporations, so that the corporations are involved in basically preventing the disclosure of UFOs. So what are some of the conclusions that we can draw? UFO Disclosure Alliance in the Obama administration, former Clinton-era officials, Clinton, Panetta, I think that there is an alliance here of interests that coincide in terms of greater openness and having the secrecy overcome, because it is a real threat, I think, to American sovereignty. So Clinton, Panetta, and these Clinton-era officials are supportive of that. This covert working group within the U.S. Navy, and I don't think it's an accident that some of Obama's senior advisors are former Navy personnel. Admiral Blair, Jones is former Marine Commandant, well, Marines are part of the Navy, really. John Podesta, Center for American Progress, and George Soros. I think the role of Soros is very important, because I think there are interests behind Soros that are kind of tap into what is termed to be a kind of third faction, if you like, of kind of global interests that really do stand for openness and government transparency and really believe in humanity. I think that there are a lot of people in official positions that believe that humanity can handle the challenges that lie ahead, that humans can be educated and raised to a level where they can deal with these challenges, and that information should be disclosed and should be shared because we can handle the truth. I think there are a lot of people in government that truly believe that, and that's why they want this to come out. There are those in government, and I think those that are part of a New World Order agenda, that don't believe that. They believe humanity are basically nothing but a bunch of sheep that need to be herded and need to be told the minimum so that they can just basically not create any fuss and basically should just do what they're told and not create a fuss. So I think we do have a kind of a struggle being played out, but I think there are a lot of people in government and in the Obama administration that really want to move forward, and I think they do have people's best interests at heart. Process is underway for Obama admin to declassify UFO files and make policy statements concerning extraterrestrial life. So I think this is the kind of picture that I hope I've portrayed, that it's kind of like a chess game. You've got two powerful sides with their respective pieces and their respective capacities and powers, and they're trying to release this stuff. Some of the challenges to all of this, how much time do I have? A minute. So some of the challenges to this, I basically talk about that in my book that's out there now. It's just come out, so it goes over all of these challenges. Secret meetings and agreements. The first chapter of the book deals with the agreements that were reached. I think you heard Art Campbell, Bill Kirkland talk about the meetings. What I do in the book, the very first chapter, and what happens after the book, I actually talk about the meetings. I give you the whistleblowers, the references, the sources, the documents as to what agreements were reached and how these meetings at Edwards and Holloman were so important. Agreements subsequently reached and kept secret. I can talk a lot about more, but I don't have the time, so let me just kind of skim over this quickly. Black budget priorities, $1.7 trillion a year is spent on deep black projects involving UFOs and ETs. The CIA, basically, it's a giant money laundering operation due to its statutory authority to, quote, expend funds without, quote, regard to any provisions of law, end quote. Basically, that makes the CIA a money laundering operation. You can get money from wherever and spend it without any regard to provisions of law. It's money laundering. 1949 CIA Act, that's when that was passed. Corporations opposed to disclosure. Corporations stand to lose lucrative contracts if open competition is introduced for black projects and secret patents made public. Anything that is made public, people are pretty bright, they will come up with better models, better patents or improvements. But if everything's secret, you have a monopoly. And I think that's why these corporations, I don't want to release that. Decades-long shoot-to-kill policy against extraterrestrial vehicles, that is something that I think will have to be dealt with. These are these are some of the challenges that really need to be looked at when we're examining the whole question of US government policy on extraterrestrial life. My book that's just come out, all the chapters deal with each of these challenges in detail. You've got the references, sources, authors, whistleblowers that lay it all out. So it's all there. I hope you have a look at it and share it with your friends, tell friends. So thank you very much.
Because of the nature of the setup, I only was able to give Michael an hour. And I can tell you, if anybody gives me an hour, I mean, I get a headache immediately, so I know what he was going through. Believe me, he could do 3 hours like that.